She leaned down, saying something very soft to the lifeless. Claude started moving again, sitting up, looking about. Vivenna waited as his eyes passed over her, but there didn't seem to be recognition in them. He wore the same dull expression. Of course, Vivenna thought, standing. He's lifeless, after all. Jules had said something to make him start working again. It was probably the same thing Jules had used to make him stop moving in the first place. That odd phrase, howl of the sun. Vivenna filed it away, then followed as they left the building. A short time later, they were home. Parlin rushed out, expressing his fears for their safety. He went to Jules first, though she brushed him off. As Vivenna entered the building, he moved up to her. Vivenna, what happened? She shook her head. There was fighting, he said, following her up the stairs. I heard about it. There was an attack on the camp we visited, Vivenna said wearily, reaching the top of the stairs. A squad of lifeless. They started killing people.
Lord of Colors, Parlin said. Is Jules all right?
Vivenna flushed, turning on the landing, looking down the stairs toward him.
Why do you ask about her?
Parlin shrugged. I think she's nice.
Should you be saying things like that?
Vivenna asked, noticing half-heartedly that her hair was turning red again.
Aren't you engaged to me?
He frowned.
You were engaged to the God King, Vivenna.
But you know what our fathers wanted,
she said, hands on hips.
I did, Parlin said. But, well, when we left Idris, I figured we were both going to get disinherited. There's really no reason to keep up the charade.
Charade? She thought.
I mean, let's be honest, Vivenna, he said, smiling. You really haven't ever been that nice to me. I know you think I'm stupid. I guess you're probably right. But if you really cared, I figured that you wouldn't make me feel stupid, too. Jules grumbles at me, but she laughs at my jokes sometimes. You've never done that.
But, Vivenna said, finding herself at a slight loss for words. But why did you follow me down to Hallandrin?
He blinked.
Well, for Ciri, of course. Isn't that why we came?
To rescue her? He smiled fondly, then shrugged. Good night, Vivenna. He trailed down the steps, calling to Jules to see if she was hurt. Vivenna watched him go.
He's twice the person I am, she thought with shame, turning toward her room. But I'm just finding it hard to care anymore. Everything had been taken from her. Why not Parlin, too?
Her hatred for Hallandrin grew a little more firm as she stepped into her room.
I just need to sleep, she thought. Maybe after that, I can figure out just what in the name of colors I'm doing in this city.
One thing remained firm. She was going to learn how to awaken. The Vivenna from before, the one who had a right to stand tall and denounce breath as unholy, no longer had a place in Teteller. The real Vivenna hadn't come to Hallandrin to save her sister. She'd come because she couldn't stand being unimportant. She'd learn. That was her punishment. Inside her room, she pushed the door closed, locking the bolt. Then she walked over to pull the drapes closed. A figure stood on her balcony, resting easily against the railing. He wore several days' worth of stubble on his face, and his dark clothing was worn, almost tattered. He carried a deep black sword. Vivenna jumped, eyes wide.
You, he said in an angry voice, are causing a lot of trouble.
She opened her mouth to scream, but the drapes snapped forward, muffling her neck and mouth. They squeezed tightly, choking her. They wrapped around her entire body, pinning her arms to her sides.
No, she thought. I survive the attack and the lifeless, and then fall in my own room? She struggled, hoping someone would hear her thrashing and come for her. But nobody did. At least, not before she fell unconscious. Chapter 34. Lightsong watched the young queen dart away from his pavilion and felt an odd sense of guilt. How very uncharacteristic of me, he thought, taking a sip of wine. After the grapes, it tasted a little sour. Maybe the sourness was from something else. He'd spoken to Ciri about the God King's death in his usual flippant way. In his opinion, it was usually best for people to hear the truth bluntly, and, if possible, amusingly. He hadn't expected such a reaction from the queen. What was the God King to her? She'd been sent to be his bride, probably against her will. Yet she seemed to take the prospect of his death with grief. He eyed her appraisingly as she fled. Such a small, young thing she was, all dressed up in gold and blue. Young? He thought. Yet she's been alive longer than I have. He retained some things from his former life, such as his perception of his own age. He didn't feel like he was 5. He felt far older. That age should have taught him to hold his tongue when speaking of making widows out of young women. Could the girl actually have feelings for the God King? She'd been in the city for only a couple of months, and he knew, through rumors, what her life must be like, forced to perform her duty as a wife for a man to whom she couldn't speak and whom she couldn't know, a man who represented all the things that her culture taught were profane. The only thing Lightsong could suppose, then, was that she was worried about what might happen to her if her husband killed himself. A legitimate worry. The queen would lose most of her stature if she lost her husband. Lightsong nodded to himself, turning to look down at the arguing priests. They were done with sewage and guard patrols and had moved on to other topics. We must prepare ourselves for war, one of them was saying. Recent events make it clear that we cannot coexist with the Idrians with any assurance of peace or security. This conflict will come, whether we wish it or not. Lightsong sat listening, tapping one finger against the armrest of his chair. For 5 years, I've been irrelevant, he thought. I didn't have a vote on any of the important court councils. I simply held the codes to a division of the lifeless. I've crafted a divine reputation of being useless. The tone below was even more hostile than it had been during previous meetings. That wasn't what worried him. The problem was the priest spearheading the movement for war. Nanrava, High Priest of Stillmark the Noble. Normally, Lightsong wouldn't have bothered paying attention, yet Nanrava had always been the most outspoken against war. What had made him change his mind? It wasn't long before Blushweaver made her way to his box. By the time she arrived, Lightsong's taste for the wine had returned, and he was sipping thoughtfully. The voices against war from below were soft and infrequent. Blushweaver sat beside him, a rustle of cloth and a waft of perfume. Lightsong didn't look toward her. How did you get to Nanrava? He finally asked.
I didn't, Blushweaver said. I don't know why he changed his mind. I wish he hadn't done it so quickly. It seems suspicious and makes people think I manipulated him. Either way, I'll take the support.
You wish for war so much.
I wish for our people to be aware of the threat, Blushweaver said. You think I want this to happen? You think I want to send our people to die and to kill?
Lightsong looked at her, judging her sincerity. She had such beautiful eyes. One rarely noticed that,
considering how she proffered the rest of her assets so blatantly.
No, he said. I don't think you want a war.
She nodded sharply. Her dress was sleek and trim this day, as always, but it was particularly revealing up top, where her breasts were pressed up and forward, demanding attention. Lightsong looked away.
You're boring today, Blushweaver said.
I'm distracted.
We should be happy, Blushweaver said. The priests have almost all come around. Soon there will be a call for attack made to the main assembly of gods.
Lightsong nodded. The main assembly of gods was called to deliberate only in the most important of situations. In that case, they all had a vote. If the vote was for war, the gods with lifeless commands, gods like Lightsong, would be called upon to administer and lead the battle.
You've changed the commands on Hopefinder's 10,000?
Lightsong asked.
She nodded. They're mine now, as are Mercy Stars.
Colors, he thought. Between the two of us, we now control 3/4 of the kingdom's armies. What in the name of the iridescent tones am I getting myself into?
Blushweaver settled back in her chair, eyeing the smaller one that Ciri had vacated.
I'm annoyed, however, at Allmother.
Because she's prettier than you, or because she's smarter?
Blushweaver didn't dignify that with a verbal response. She just shot him a look of annoyance.
Just trying to act less boring, my dear, he said.
Allmother controls the last group of lifeless, Blushweaver said.
An odd choice, don't you think?
Lightsong said. I mean, I am a logical choice, assuming you don't know me, of course, since I'm supposedly bold. Hopefinder represents justice, a nice mix with soldiers. Even Mercy Star, who represents benevolence, makes a kind of sense for one who controls soldiers. But Allmother, goddess of matrons and families? Giving her 10,000 lifeless is enough to make even me consider my drunk monkey theory.
The one who chooses names and titles of the returned?
Exactly, Lightsong said. I've actually considered expanding the theory. I am now proposing to believe that God, or the universe, or time, or whatever you think controls all of this, is all really just a drunk monkey.
She leaned over, squeezing her arms together, seriously threatening to pop her bosom out the front of her dress.
And you think my title was chosen by happenstance? Goddess of honesty and interpersonal relations? Seems to fit, wouldn't you say?
He hesitated. Then he smiled. My dear, did you just try to prove the existence of God with your cleavage?
She smiled.
You'd be surprised what a good wriggle of the chest can accomplish.
I had never considered the theological power of your breasts, my dear. If there were a church devoted to them, perhaps you'd make a theist out of me after all. Regardless, are you going to tell me what specifically Allmother did to annoy you?
She won't give me her lifeless commands.
Not surprising, Lightsong said. I hardly trust you, and I'm your friend.
We need those security phrases, Lightsong.
Why? He asked. We've got 3 of the 4. We dominate the armies already.
We can't afford infighting or divisiveness, Blushweaver said. If her 10 were to turn against our 30, we'd win, but we'd be left badly weakened.
He frowned. Surely she wouldn't do that.
Surely we'd rather be certain.
Lightsong sighed. Very well, then. I'll talk to her.
That might not be a good idea.
He raised an eyebrow.
She doesn't like you very much.
Yes, I know, he said. She has remarkably good taste, unlike some other people I know.
She glared at him. Do I need to wriggle my breasts at you again?
No, please. I don't know if I'd be able to stand the theological debate that would follow.
All right, then, she said, sitting back,
looking down at the priests who were still arguing. They sure are taking a long time on this one, he thought. He glanced toward the other side, where Ciri had paused to look out over the arena, her arms resting on the stonework. It was too high for her to do so comfortably. Perhaps it wasn't thinking of her husband's death that bothered her, he thought. Maybe it was because the discussion turned to war. A war her people couldn't win. That was another good reason why the conflict was becoming inevitable. As Hoyd had implied, when one side had an unbeatable advantage, war was the result. Halandrin had been building its lifeless armies for centuries, and the size was becoming daunting. Halandrin had less and less to lose from an attack. He should have realized that earlier, rather than assuming this would all blow over once the new queen arrived. Blushweaver huffed beside him, and he noticed that she had noticed his study of Ciri. She was watching the queen with obvious dislike. Lightsong immediately changed the topic. Do you know anything about a tunnel complex beneath the Court of Gods? Blushweaver turned back toward him, shrugging. Sure. Some of the palaces have tunnels beneath them, places for storage and the like. Have you ever been down in any of them? Please, why would I go crawling about in storage tunnels? I only know about them because of my High Priestess. When she joined my service, she asked me if I wanted mine connected to the main complex of tunnels. I said I didn't. Because you didn't want others to have access to your palace? No, she said, turning back to watching the priests below. Because I didn't want to put up with the racket of all that digging. Can I have some more wine, please? Ciri watched the proceedings for quite a long time. She felt a little like Lightsong said he did. Because she didn't have a say about what the court did, it was frustrating to pay attention. Yet she wanted to know. The arguments of the priests were, in a way, her only connection to the outside world. She wasn't encouraged by what she heard. As the time passed, the sun falling close to the horizon and servants lighting massive torches along the walkway, Ciri found herself feeling more and more daunted. Her husband was probably either going to be killed or persuaded to kill himself in the upcoming year. Her homeland, in turn, was about to be invaded by the very kingdom her husband ruled, yet he could do nothing to stop it, because he had no way to communicate. Then there was the guilt she felt for actually enjoying all the challenges and problems. Back home, she'd had to be contrary and disobedient to find any kind of excitement. Here, she only had to stand and watch, and things would begin to topple against each other and cause a clatter. There was far too much clatter at present, but that didn't stop her from thrilling at her part in it. Silly fool, she told herself. Everything you love is in danger, and you're thinking about how exciting it is? She needed to find a way to help Sisebron. In doing so, perhaps she could bring him out from beneath the oppressive control of the priests. Then he might be able to do something to help her homeland. As she followed that line of thought, she almost missed a comment from below. It was spoken by one of the priests most strongly in favor of attacking. Have you not heard of the Idrian agent who has been causing havoc in the city? The priest asked. The Idrians are preparing for the war. They know that a conflict is inevitable, and so they've begun to work against us. Ciri perked up. Idrian agents in the city?
Bah, said another of the priests. The infiltrator you speak of is said to be a princess of the royal family. That's obviously a story for the common people. Why would a princess come in secret to Teteller? These stories are ridiculous and unfounded.
Ciri grimaced. That, at least, was obviously true. Her sisters weren't the types to come and work as Idrian agents. She smiled, imagining her soft-spoken monk of a sister, or even Vivenna, in her prim outfits and stony attitude, coming to Teteller in secret. Part of her had a little trouble believing that Vivenna had really been intended to become Sisebron's bride. Starchy Vivenna? Having to deal with the exotic court and the wild costumes? Vivenna's stoic coldness would never have coaxed Sisebron out of his imperial mask. Vivenna's obvious disapproval would have alienated her from gods like Lightsong. Vivenna would have hated wearing the beautiful dresses and would never have appreciated the colors and variety in the city. Ciri might not have been ideal for the position, but she was slowly coming to realize that Vivenna hadn't been a good choice either. A group of people was approaching along the walkway. Ciri remained where she was. She was too distracted by her thoughts to pay much attention.
"Are they talking about a relative of yours?"
a voice asked. Ciri started, spinning. Behind her stood a dark-haired goddess wearing a lavish and revealing gown of green and silver. Like most of the gods, she stood a good head taller than a mortal person, and she looked down at Ciri with a raised eyebrow.
"Your grace?"
Ciri responded, confused.
"They're discussing the famous hidden princess," the goddess said with a wave of her hand. "She'd be a relative of yours, if she really does have the royal locks."
Ciri glanced back at the priests.
"They must be mistaken. I'm the only princess here." "The stories of her are quite pervasive."
Ciri fell silent.
"My light song has taken a liking to you, princess,"
the goddess said, folding her arms.
"He has been very kind to me,"
Ciri said carefully, trying to present the right image, that of the person she was, only less threatening, a little more confused.
"Might I ask which goddess you are, your grace?" "I am Blushweaver,"
the goddess said.
"I am pleased to meet you."
"No, you aren't," Blushweaver said. She leaned in, eyes narrowing.
"I don't like what you're doing here."
"Excuse me?" Blushweaver raised a finger.
"He's a better man than any of us, princess. Don't you go spoiling him and pulling him into your schemes."
"I don't know what you mean."
"You don't fool me with your false naivete,"
Blushweaver said.
"Lightsong is a good person, one of the last ones we have left in this court. If you taint him, I will destroy you. Do you understand?"
Ciri nodded, dumbly. Then Blushweaver turned and moved away, muttering,
"Find someone else's bed to climb into, you little slut."
Ciri watched her go, shocked. When she finally regained her composure, she blushed furiously, then fled. By the time she got back to the palace, Ciri was quite ready for her bath. She entered the bathing chamber, letting her serving women undress her. They retreated with the clothing, then exited to prepare the evening's gown. That left Ciri in the hands of a group of lesser attendants, the ones whose job it was to follow her into the massive tub and scrub her clean. Ciri relaxed and leaned back, sighing as the women went to work. Another group, standing fully clothed in the deep water, pulled her hair straight and then cut most of it free, something she'd ordered them to do every night. For a few moments, Ciri floated and let herself forget the threats to her people and her husband. She even let herself forget Blushweaver and her snappish misunderstanding. She just enjoyed the heat and the scents of the perfumed water.
"You wanted to speak with me, my queen?"
a voice asked. Ciri started, splashing as she dunked her body beneath the water.
"Blue fingers," she snapped. "I thought we'd cleared this up on the first day."
He stood at the rim of the tub, fingers blue, typically anxious as he began to pace.
"Oh, please," he said. "I have daughters twice your age. You sent word that you wanted to talk to me. Well, this is where I will talk, away from random ears."
He nodded to several of the serving girls, and they began to splash just a bit more, speaking quietly, creating a low noise. Ciri flushed, her short hair a deep red, though a few cut-off strands that floated in the water remained blonde.
"Haven't you gotten over your shyness yet?"
Bluefingers asked.
"You've been in Halandrin for months."
Ciri eyed him, but didn't relax her concealing posture. Even if she did let the serving women continue to work on her hair and scrub her back.
"Won't it seem suspicious to have the serving women making so much noise?" she asked.
Bluefingers waved a hand.
"They're already considered second-class servants by most of the palace."
She understood what he meant. These women, as opposed to her regular servants, wore brown. They were from Pankal.
"You sent me a message earlier,"
Bluefinger said.
"What did you mean by claiming to have information relating to my plans?"
Ciri bit her lip, sorting through the dozens of ideas she had considered, discarding them all. What did she know? How could she make Bluefingers willing to trade?
"He gave me clues," she thought. "He tried to scare me into not sleeping with the king, but he had no reason to help me. He barely knew me. He must have other motives for not wanting an heir to be born."
"What happens when a new god king takes the throne?" she asked carefully. He eyed her.
"So you've figured that out, then?"
"Figured out what?" she thought. "Of course I have," she said out loud. He wrung his hands nervously.
"Of course, of course. Then you can see why I'm so nervous. We worked hard to get me where I am. It isn't easy for a Pankal man to rise high in the theocracy of Halandrin. Once I got into place, I worked so hard to provide work for my people. The serving girls who wash you, they have far better lives than the Pankal who work the dye fields. That will all be lost. We don't believe in their gods. Why would we be treated as well as people of their own faith?"
"I still don't see why it has to happen," Ciri said carefully. He waved a nervous hand.
"Of course it doesn't have to, but tradition is tradition. The Halandrin are very lax in every area but religion. When a new god king is chosen, his servants are replaced. They won't kill us to send us into the afterlife along with our lord. That horrid custom hasn't been in effect since the days before the Many War, but we will be dismissed. A new god king represents a fresh start."
He stopped pacing, looking at her. She was still naked in the water, awkwardly covering herself as best she could.
"But," he said, "I guess my job security is the lesser of our problems."
Ciri snorted. "Don't tell me you're worried about my safety above your own place in the palace."
"Of course not,"
he said, kneeling down beside the tub, speaking quietly.
"But the god king's life, well, that worries me."
"So," Ciri said, "I haven't been able to decide yet. Do the god kings give up their lives willingly once they have an heir, or are they coerced into it?"
"I'm not sure," Bloodfingers admitted. "There are stories spoken of by my people regarding the last god king's death. They say that the plague he cured, well, he wasn't even in the city when the curing happened. My suspicion is that they somehow coerced him to give up his breaths to his son, and that killed him."
"He doesn't know," Ciri thought. "He doesn't realize that Sesebron is a mute." "How closely have you served the God King?" He shrugged.
"As close as any servant considered unholy. I'm not allowed to touch him or speak to him. But, Princess, I've served him all my life. He's not my god, but he's something better. I think these priests look upon their gods as placeholders. It doesn't really matter to them who is holding the station. Me? I've served His Majesty for my entire life. I was hired by the palace as a lad, and I remember Sesebron's childhood. I cleaned his quarters. He's not my god, but he is my liege. And now these priests are planning to kill him.
He turned back to his pacing, wringing his hands.
But there's nothing to be done.
Yes, there is, she said.
He waved a hand. I gave you a warning, and you ignored it. I know that you've been performing your duties as a wife. Perhaps we could find some way of making certain that no pregnancy of yours comes to term.
Ciri flushed. I would never do such a thing. Astra forbids it.
Even to save the life of the God King? But, of course. What is he to you? Your captor and imprisoner. Yes. Perhaps my warnings were useless.
I do care, Bluefingers, she said. And I think we can stop this before it gets to the point of worrying about an heir. I've been talking to the God King.
Bluefingers froze, looking directly at her.
What?
I've been talking to him, Ciri admitted. He's not as heartless as you might think. I don't think this has to end with him dying or your people losing their places in the palace.
Bluefingers studied her, staring at her to the point that she flushed again, ducking further down into the water.
I see that you've found yourself a position of power, he noted.
Or at least one that looks powerful,
she thought ruefully.
If things turn out as I want them to, I'll make certain your people are cared for.
And my side of the bargain?
He asked.
If things don't turn out as I want them to, she said,
taking a deep breath, heart fluttering.
I want you to get Sisebron and me out of the palace.
Silence. Deal, he said. But let us make certain it does not come to that. Is the God King aware of the danger from his own priests?
He is, Ciri lied. In fact, he knew about it before I did. He's the one who told me I needed to contact you.
He did?
Bluefingers asked, frowning slightly.
Yes, Ciri said. I will be in touch on how to make this turn out well for all of us. And until then, I would appreciate it if you'd let me get back to my bath.
Bluefingers nodded slowly, then retreated from the bathing chamber. Ciri, however, found it hard to still her nerves. She wasn't certain if she'd handled the exchange well or not. She seemed to have gained something. Now, she just had to figure out how to use it.
Chapter 35 Vivenna awoke sore, tired, and terrified. She tried struggling, but her hands and legs were tied. She succeeded only in rolling herself into an even less comfortable position. She was in a dark room, gagged, her face pressing awkwardly against a splintering wood floor. She still wore her skirt, an expensive foreign one, like those that Denth complained about. Her hands were tied behind her. Someone was in the room with her, someone with a lot of breath. She could feel it without even trying. She twisted, rolling onto her back in an awkward motion. She could see a figure silhouetted against a starlit sky, standing on a balcony a short distance away. It was him. He turned toward her, face shadowed in the unlit room, and she began to squirm with panic. What was this man planning to do with her? Horrible possibilities leaped to mind. The man walked toward her, feet thumping roughly on the floor, the wood shaking. He knelt down, pulling her head up by the hair.
I'm still deciding whether or not to kill you, princess,
he said.
If I were you, I'd avoid doing anything more to antagonize me.
His voice was deep, thick, and had an accent she couldn't place. She froze in his grip, trembling, hair bleached white. He appeared to be studying her, eyes reflecting starlight. He dropped her back to the wooden floor. She groaned through the gag as he lit a lantern, then pushed the balcony doors closed. He reached to his belt and removed a large hunting dagger. Vivenna felt a stab of fear, but he simply walked over and cut the bonds on her hands. He tossed the dagger aside, and it made a thock as it stuck into the wood of the far wall. He reached for something on the bed, his large, black-hilted sword. Vivenna scrambled back, hands free, and pulled at her gag, intending to scream. He whipped the scabbarded sword toward her, making her freeze.
"You will remain quiet,"
he said sharply. She huddled back into the corner. "How is this happening to me?" she thought. Why hadn't she fled back to Idris long ago? She'd been deeply unsettled when Denth had killed the ruffians in the restaurant. She'd known then that she was dealing with people and situations that were truly dangerous. She'd been an arrogant fool to think that she could do anything in this city, this monstrous, overwhelming, terrible city. She was nothing, barely a peasant from the countryside. Why had she been determined to get herself involved in this people's politics and schemes? The man, Vasher, stepped forward. He undid the clasp on that deep black sword, and Vivenna felt a strange nausea strike her. A thin wisp of black smoke began to curl up from the blade. Vasher approached, backlit by the lantern, the sheathed tip of the sword dragging along the floor behind him. Then he dropped the sword to the floor in front of Vivenna.
"Pick it up," he said.
She untensed slightly, looking up. Though she still huddled in the corner, she felt tears on her cheeks.
"Pick up the sword, princess."
She had no training with weapons, but maybe. She reached for the sword, but felt her nausea grow far stronger. She groaned, her hand twitching as it approached the strange black blade. She shied away.
"Pick it up,"
Vasher bellowed. She complied with a gagged cry of desperation, grabbing the weapon, feeling a terrible sickness travel like a wave up her arm and into her stomach. She found herself ripping away her gag with desperate fingers.
"Hello," a voice said in her head. "Would you like to kill someone today?"
She dropped the horrid weapon and fell to her knees, retching onto the floor. There wasn't much in her stomach, but she couldn't stop herself. When she was done, she crawled away and huddled down against the wall again, mouth dripping with bile, feeling too sick to yell for help or even wipe her face. She was crying again. That seemed the least of her humiliations. Through teary eyes, she watched as Vasher stood quietly. Then he grunted, as if in surprise, and picked up the sword. He clicked the clasp on its sheath, locking the weapon back inside, then threw a towel onto what she'd retched up.
"We are in one of the slums," he said. "You may scream if you wish, but nobody will think anything of it. Except me. I'll be annoyed."
He glanced back at her.
"I warn you, I'm not known for my ability to keep my temper."
Vivenna shivered, still feeling hints of nausea. This man held even more breath than she did. Yet when he'd kidnapped her, she hadn't felt anyone standing in her room. How had he hidden it? And what was that voice? They seemed silly things to distract her, considering her current situation. However, she used them to keep from thinking about what this man might do to her. What? He was walking toward her again. He picked up the gag, his expression dark. She finally screamed, trying to scramble away, and he cursed, putting a foot on her back and forcing her down against the floor. He tied her hands again before forcing on the gag. She cried, her voice muffled as he jerked her backward. He stood, then slung her over his shoulder and carried her out of the room.
"Color's cursed slums," he muttered. "Everyone's too poor to afford cellars."
He pushed her into a sitting position in the doorway of a second, much smaller room, and retied her hands to the doorknob. He stepped back, looking her over, obviously unsatisfied. Then he knelt beside her, unshaven face close to hers, breath vile.
"I have work to do," he said. "Work that you have forced me to do. You will not run. If you do, I'll find you and kill you. Understand?"
She nodded weakly. She caught sight of him retrieving his sword from the other room. Then he ran down the stairs. The door below slammed and locked, leaving her alone and helpless. An hour or so later, Vivenna had finished crying herself dry. She sat slumped, hands tied awkwardly above her. Part of her kept waiting for the others to find her. Denth, Tong Fa, Jules. They were experts. They'd be able to save her. No rescue came. Dazed, drowsy, and sick though she was, she realized something. This man, this Vasher, was someone that even Denth had feared. Vasher had killed one of their friends some months before. He was at least as skilled as they were. How did they all end up here, then? She thought, her wrists rubbed raw. It seems an unlikely coincidence. Perhaps Vasher had followed Denth to the city and was acting out some kind of twisted rivalry by working against them. They'll find me and save me. But she knew that they wouldn't, not if Vasher was as dangerous as they said. He'd know how to hide from Denth. If she was going to escape, she'd have to do it herself. The concept terrified her. Strangely, however, memories from her tutors returned to her. "There are things to do if you are kidnapped," one had taught, "things that every princess should know." During her time in Teteller, she'd begun to feel that her lessons were useless. Now she was surprised to find herself remembering sessions that related directly to her situation. "If a person kidnaps you," the tutor had taught, "your best time to escape is near the beginning, when you are still strong. They will starve you and beat you, so that soon you will be too weak to flee. Do not expect to be rescued, though friends will undoubtedly be working to help you. Never expect to be redeemed for a ransom. Most kidnappings end in death. The best thing you can do for your country is try to escape. If you don't succeed, then perhaps the captor will kill you. That is preferable to what you might have to endure as a captive. Plus, if you die, the kidnappers will no longer have a hostage." It was a harsh, blunt lesson, but many of her lessons had been like that. Better to die than to be held captive and used against Idris. That was the same lesson that warned her that the Halandrin might try to use her against Idris once she was there as queen. In such a case, she was told that her father might be forced to order her assassination. That was a problem she didn't have to worry about anymore. The kidnapping advice, however, seemed useful. It frightened her, made her want to cower in place and simply wait, hoping that Vasher would find a reason to let her go. But the more she thought, the more she knew that she had to be strong. He'd been extremely harsh with her, exaggeratedly so. He'd wanted to frighten her so that she wouldn't try to escape. He'd cursed for not having a cellar, for that would have been a good place to secret her. When he returned, he would probably move her to a more secure location. The tutors were right. The only chance she had to escape was now. Her hands were bound tightly. She'd tried pulling them free several times already. Vasher knew his knots. She wriggled, rubbing more skin off, and she cringed in pain. Blood began to drip down her wrists, but even that slickness wasn't enough to get her hands free. She began to cry again, not in fear, but in pain and frustration. She couldn't wriggle her way out. But could she perhaps make the ropes untie themselves? Why didn't I let Denth train me with breath sooner? Her stubborn self-righteousness seemed even more flagrant to her now. Of course it was better to use the breath than it was to be killed, or worse, by Vasher. She thought she understood Lemix and his desire to gather enough biochroma to extend his life. She tried to speak some commands through her gag. That was useless. Even she knew that the commands had to be spoken clearly. She began to wiggle her chin, pushing on the gag with her tongue. It didn't appear to be as tight as her wrist bonds. Plus, it was wet from her tears and saliva. She worked at it, moving her lips and her teeth. She was actually surprised when it finally dropped loose below her chin. She licked her lips, working her sore jaw. Now what? She thought. Her apprehension was rising. Now she really needed to get free. If Vasher returned and saw that she'd managed to work her gag off, he'd never leave her with such an opportunity again. He might punish her for disobeying him.
Ropes, she said. Untie yourself.
Nothing happened. She gritted her teeth, trying to remember the commands that Denth had told her. Hold things and protect me. Neither seemed all that useful in her situation. She certainly didn't want the ropes to hold her wrists more tightly. However, he had said something else, something about imagining what you wanted in your mind. She tried that, picturing the ropes untying themselves.
Untie yourselves, she said clearly.
Again, nothing happened. Vivenna leaned her head back in frustration. Awakening seemed such a vague art, which was odd, considering the number of rules and restrictions it appeared to have. Or maybe it just seemed vague to her because it was so complicated. She closed her eyes. I have to get this, she thought. I must figure it out. If I don't, I will be killed. She opened her eyes, focusing on her bonds, pictured them untying again, but somehow that felt wrong. She was like a child, sitting and staring at a leaf, trying to make it move just by concentrating on it. That wasn't the way her newfound senses worked. They were part of her. So, instead of concentrating, she relaxed, letting her unconscious mind do the work. A little like she did when she changed the color of her hair.
Untie, she commanded.
The breath flowed from her. It was like blowing bubbles beneath the water, exhaling a piece of herself but feeling it flow into something else. That something else became part of her, a limb she could only slightly control. It was more of a sense of the rope than an ability to move it. As the breath left her, she could feel the world dull, colors becoming slightly less bold, the wind a little more difficult to hear, the life of the city a little more distant. The ropes around her hands jerked, causing her wrists to burn. Then the ropes unraveled and dropped to the ground. Her arms came free, and she sat, staring at her wrists, shocked.
Astra, Lord of Colors, she thought. I did it.
She wasn't certain whether to be impressed or ashamed. Either way, she knew she needed to run. She untied her ankles, then scrambled to her feet, noticing that a section of the wooden door had been completely drained of color in a circular pattern around her hands. She paused only briefly, then grabbed the rope and ran down the stairs. She unlocked the door and peeked out the doorway onto the street, but it was dark, and she could see little. Taking a deep breath, she rushed out into the night. She walked aimlessly for a time, trying to put space between herself and Vasher's lair. She knew that she should probably find a place to hide, but she was afraid. She was distinctive in her fine dress and would be remembered by all who passed. Her only real hope was to get out of the slums and into the city proper, where she could find her way back to Denth and the others. She carried the rope tucked into the dress's pocket pouch, hidden behind a fold of cloth on the side. She'd grown so accustomed to having a certain amount of breath that missing a fraction, even the small bit contained in the rope, felt wrong. Awakeners could recover breath they invested into objects. She'd been tutored on that. She just didn't know the commands to do it. So she brought the rope, hoping that Denth would be able to help her recover its breath. She maintained a quick pace, head down, trying to watch for a discarded cloak or piece of cloth she could wrap around herself to hide the dress. Fortunately, it seemed as if the hour was too late, even for most ruffians. She did occasionally see shadowed figures on the sides of the road, and she had trouble keeping her heart stilled as she passed them. If only the sun were up, she thought. It was just beginning to grow light in the morning's arrival, but it was still dark enough that she had trouble telling which direction she was going. The slums were convoluted enough that she felt she was going in circles. The tall buildings loomed around her, blocking off the sky. This area had once been much more rich. The shadowed fronts of the buildings held worn engravings and faded colors. The square down the street to her left held an old broken statue of a man atop a horse, perhaps part of a fountain or... Vivenna stopped. A broken statue of a horseman? Why did that seem familiar? Dent's directions, she thought, when he explained to Parlin how to get from the safe house to the restaurant. That day, weeks back, seemed so vague to her now, but she did remember the exchange. She'd been worried that Parlin would get lost. For the first time in hours, she felt a sense of hope. The directions had been simple. Could she remember them? She worked, walking hesitantly, partially just on instinct. After just a few minutes, she realized that the dark street around her looked familiar. There were no lamps in the slums, but the light of false dawn was enough. She turned around, and sure enough, the safe house lay huddled between two larger buildings across from her. Blessed Ostra, she thought with relief, quickly crossing the street and pushing her way into the building. The main room was empty, and she hurriedly opened the door down to the cellar, seeking a place to hide. She searched around with her fingers, and sure enough, she found a lantern with flint and steel beside the stairway. She pulled the door closed and found it more sturdy than she would have assumed. That felt good, though she couldn't lock it from this side. She left it unlatched and bent down to light the lantern. A set of worn, broken stairs led down into the cellar. Vivenna paused, remembering that Denth had warned her about the steps. She walked down carefully, feeling them creak beneath her, and could see why he'd been worried. Still, she made it down all right. At the bottom, she wrinkled her nose at the musty scent. The carcasses of several small game hung on the wall. Someone had been here recently, which was a good sign. She rounded the stairs. The main space of the cellar was built beneath the floor of the upper room. She would rest there for a few hours, and if Denth didn't arrive, she'd venture out. Then she froze, jerking to a halt, lantern swinging in her hand. Its unsteady light shone on a figure sitting before her, head bowed, face shadowed. His arms were tied behind his back, and his ankles were bound to the legs of the chair. Parlin? Vivenna asked with shock, rushing to his side. She quickly set down the lantern, then froze. There was blood on the floor. Parlin, she said louder, urgently lifting his head. His eyes stared forward, sightless, his face scratched and bloody. Her life sense couldn't feel him. His eyes were dead. Vivenna's hands began to shake. She stumbled back, horrified. Oh, colors, she found herself mumbling.
Colors, colors, colors.
A hand fell on her shoulder. She screamed, spinning. A large figure stood in the darkness behind her, half hidden beneath the stairs.
Hello, princess,
Tonk Fa said. He smiled. Vivenna stumbled back, nearly colliding with Parlin's body. She began to gasp, hand on her chest. Only then did she notice the bodies on the walls. Not game animals. What she had mistaken for a pheasant in the dim light of her lantern now reflected back green. A dead parrot. A monkey hung beside, body sliced and cut. The freshest corpse was that of a large lizard. All had been tortured.
Oh, Astra,
she whispered. Tonk Fa stepped forward, grabbing for her, and Vivenna finally shocked herself into motion. She ducked to the side, escaping his reach. She ran around the large man, scrambling toward the stairs. She came up short as she collided with someone's chest. She looked up, blinking.
Do you know what I hate most about being a mercenary, princess?
Denth asked quietly, grabbing her arm.
Fulfilling the stereotypes. Everyone assumes that they can't trust you. The thing is, they really can't.
We do what we're paid to,
Tonk Fa said, stepping up behind her.
It's not exactly the most desirable work,
Denth said, holding her tightly.
But the money is good. I was hoping we wouldn't have to do this. Everything was going so nicely. Why did you run away? What tipped you off?
He pushed her forward with a careful hand, still holding her arm, as Jules and Claude moved down the steps behind him. The stairs groaned beneath the weight.
You've been lying to me the entire time,
she whispered, tears almost unnoticed on her cheeks, heart thumping as she tried to make sense of the world.
Why?
Kidnapping is hard work,
Denth said.
Terrible business,
Tonk Fa added.
It's better if your subject never even knows they've been kidnapped. They always kept an eye on me, staying near.
Lemmix
didn't do what we needed him to,
Denth said.
Poison was too good a death for that one. You should have known, princess, with as much breath as he held.
He couldn't have died from sickness,
she realized.
Astra.
Her mind was numb. She glanced at Parlin.
He's dead.
Parlin is dead. They killed him.
Don't look at him,
Denth said, delicately turning her head away from the corpse.
That was an accident. Listen to me, princess. You'll be all right. We won't hurt you. Just tell me why you ran away.
Parlin insisted he didn't know where you had gone, though we knew he spoke to you on the stairs right before you vanished.
Did you really leave without telling him?
Why?
What made you suspect us? Did one of your father's agents contact you? I thought we found all of those when they entered the city.
She shook her head dumbly.
This is important, princess,
Denth said calmly.
I need to know. Whom did you contact? What did you tell the slumlords about me?
He began to squeeze her arm tightly.
We wouldn't want to have to break anything,
Tonk Fa said.
You Idrians, you break too easily.
What had once seemed light-hearted banter to her now seemed terrible and callous. Tong Fa loomed in the shadowy lantern light to her